welcome to your talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill and this is the Saturn programme for Saturday, April the 13th, 2024. I do hope you're all well and enjoying life. If you're expecting to hear Marley's dulcet tones, I should explain that due to a short trip I'm taking next week, Marley kindly agreed to swap programme dates with me. But she'll be back next week with Red Saturn. The music you're hearing is a medley of two traditional Irish tunes, The Ashplant and Red Haired Lass, played by the marvellous flautist Jacqueline Hines. It's taken from her CD Silver and Wood. Jacqueline is a leading exponent of folk styles in the UK, as well as lecturing in folk and flute at Morley College in London and the Leeds College of Music. She has kindly allowed us to include this track, which of course I will play in full at the end of the programme. This week, as usual, we have the news stories, the radio selections and the audio-described television listings, followed by an opportunity to listen again to Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes. Rupert provided us with his fascinating reports for many years, but his ability to spend time observing nature was somewhat curtailed during lockdown. Here is the April 2021 edition, written during that time. We follow this with a short quiz, with questions from film, TV and sport. After which you may feel the urge to get up and stretch a bit, so we have our familiar 10 today set of gentle exercises to help keep you moving at home. Our popular series of short accounts of events that took place this week and the past is next, followed by a couple of articles from Hearts Life magazine. The first is about Eric Blair, also known as George Orwell, of course, and how his time living in rural Hertfordshire inspired one of his most famous books, Animal Farm. The second article, read by Sue, celebrates Women's History Month by offering short biographies of 10 Hearts women who were pioneers and social activists. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Jenny, Vivian, Claire, and Margaret.
Hello, I'm Jenny, and today my first story is Cause of Bus Crash Unknown. Police trying to establish what happened. Police have confirmed that the cause of a crash involving a bus and multiple cars in St Albans is currently unknown after an appeal was launched. The incident happened around 3:10 p.m. on Thursday, April 4th in Hatfield Road, when a green single-decker bus was travelling east towards Hatfield and was involved in a collision with multiple cars. The bus then came to rest after striking a wall, and the driver, a man aged in his 60s, was taken to hospital. Police said the reasons for the crash were currently unknown as they tried to establish the cause of the incident. Our inquiries continue as we work to establish the full circumstances around this collision, said Sergeant Matthew O'Neill from the Bedfordshire, Cambridgeshire and Hertfordshire Road Policing Unit. If you were driving in the area at the time and have a dash cam fitted, please check it, as you may have recorded some crucial footage. Additionally, if you saw what happened, you can email me at matthew.o'neill@hearts.police.uk. We are particularly keen to hear from any passengers who were travelling on the bus and left the scene before police arrived, as they may have important information to help progress our investigation.
Hello, this is Vivian. The first item is pub specials added to menu. Restaurant details for 2024, Pub in the Park revealed by Piers Bates. AA Rosette restaurants and Pan Asian eateries are included in this year's restaurant lineup for St Albans Pub in the Park. The festival, created by celebrity chef Tom Kerridge, will take place from Friday, September the 6th to Sunday, September the 8th this year. Paloma Faith, Ollie Mers, and Tiny Temper will all perform, along with last year's Foodies Festival headliner, Scouting for Girls. Alongside the music, restaurants will showcase their food to festival goers, and a pub special dish will be included for the first time. A spokesperson for the festival said, "The pub special is a dish that brings something a little extra special to the table. Expect bold flavours and premium ingredients as the chefs create completely new dishes or rework house favourites." Speaking of the St. Albans leg of the popular festival, the spokesperson continued, "A favourite addition for Londoners visiting St. Albans this year is a Sticky Mango, a Pan-Asian restaurant with central locations in London's Waterloo and Tower Bridge."
Five win £50,000 or more on premium bonds. Five Hertfordshire residents have won £50,000 or more on April's NS&I premium bonds. Every month, two winners take home £1 million with a variety of other prizes available. The second largest prize of £100,000 was won by 87 people across the UK this month. Here's every Hertfordshire bond to win over £25,000 in April 2024's draw. 1. £100,000 prize, bond value of £50, purchased in May 1999. 2. £100,000 prize, bond value of £25, purchased in August 2018. 3. £100,000 prize, bond value of £10,000, purchased in October 2012. 4. £50,000 prize, bond value of £30,000, purchased in September 2011. 5. £50,000 prize, bond value of £5,000, purchased in September 1998. Further information about premium bonds can be found at www.nsandi.com.
Hello, my name's Margaret Cox. Conservative group aims to kick out Bim Afolomi. A Conservative group is running a campaign to oust Bim Afolomi as the MP for Hitchin. The Conservative Post, a Conservative news website, is calling on local party members to deselect Mr. Afolomi and nine other sitting MPs who they believe are Liberal centrists rather than actual centre-right Conservatives. If 10% of Conservative Party members within a given association send in letters of no confidence in their MP, they can be deselected ahead of the next general election. Mr. Afolomi, currently MP for Hitchin and Harpenden, was selected a year ago as candidate for the new Hitchin constituency. A statement on the Conservative Post website reads, "For too long, there have been concerns the Conservative Party's candidates department have been weeding out actual centre-right Conservatives and pushing Liberal centrists. Let's change that. It's time to start flexing our muscles and steering our party back to proper conservatism. We want MPs who promote proper conservative values. Free speech, free markets, free people, low taxes, small government, Brexit and Britain. Poll after poll show the country is also calling out for this." They said that Conservative Party members have told them the first 10 MPs they want deselected, Mr. Afolomi, was contacted for comment.
Best Friends feature a new series of hit BBC show. Two friends from St. Albans feature in the latest series of Race Across the World, which started last night, Wednesday, on BBC One. Alfie and Owen, both aged 20, are best friends from school and are racing to beat four other teams to a £20,000 cash prize. In the show, T teams of two must race to their destination without any smartphones, internet access, or credit cards. They can use any mode of travel apart from air travel and are given a limited amount of cash to help them make their journey. In the fourth series, the teams are taking on a 15,000-kilometer route through several countries in Eastern Asia. Starting in northern Japan, they must make it through several checkpoints before arriving at Lombok, an idyllic Indonesian island. Alfie, a football referee, said they wanted to take part in the series because they're both lovers of travelling and have done a little bit of travelling before but never done the whole backpacking, country-hopping situation. On the restrictions they'll face during their travels, Owen, a trainee pilot, said, "It's going to be a challenge because it's so easy just to look up a map on your phone and know exactly where you're going and exactly how much it's going to cost. So obviously, we're not going to have that. I also think travelling with just cash is going to be quite tricky." And there's a picture of the pair of them in their backpacks, all ready to go.
The next item is called Plans for Two New Homes on Green Space. Plans have been submitted for two new homes to be constructed on garden land in St. Albans. The application would see land between 21 and 22 Antonine Gate used for two detached dwellings with associated parking and landscaping. A planning statement included with the application reads, "The existing land makes a neutral contribution to the character and appearance of the area and not of any defined nature conservation merit. The new dwellings designs are intended to be appropriate and respectful and draw inspiration from the existing dwellings in the immediate surrounds." An objection, written by a resident of Jerome Drive, reads, "This is one of the green spaces that are part of the character of the estate. Building on it will make it a significantly worse place to live. By removing green spaces, which are good for the environment and the mental and physical well-being of residents." Another resident of Westfields added, "A prominent green space, adding significantly to the enjoyment of the estate as a whole. The application would lead to overdevelopment of a small site." Five further objections were made to the plans.
Businesses named as Muddy Stiletto's finalists. More than 10 independent businesses in St. Albans and the surrounding areas have made it to the regional finals of the Muddy Stiletto's Awards. Residents now have the chance to vote for their favourites to make it to the national final of the popular Small Business Awards. Voting in the Hearts and Beds Muddy Stiletto's Awards regional finals has already opened, and residents have until 1 p.m. on April the 18th to choose their favourite in each category. Five businesses have made it to the regional finals in each of the 21 categories, with our local finalists as follows. Best Bar, Vin Santo, Harpenden. Best Beauty Salon, Clinic, SK Inspire, St. Albans. Best Cafe, Nook, Markiate. Best Family Attraction, Willows Activity Farm, St. Albans. Best Hair Salon, Mosaic Hair Studio, St. Albans, and Trinder Hair Studios, St. Albans. Best Hotel, Sopwell House, St. Albans. Best Wine and Beer Specialist, Beer Shop, St. Albans, Cellar Door Wines, St. Albans, Wine Sisters, Redbourne. Best Women's Fashion, Accessories, Lou Murphy Styles, Harpenden.
The Harding Choir to perform spring concert. The Harding Choir, a community ensemble established in 1966, is presenting a spring concert at Harpenden High Street Methodist Church. The concert will take place at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday, April the 20th. Tickets are available on the choir's website at www.hardingchoir.org, at the door or by calling 0845 475 1664. Tickets cost £17, £9 for students with under 16s going free. The programme includes cathedral anthems such as I Was Glad by Hubert Parry and Handel's Arrival of the Queen of Sheba, as well as the concerto for organ and piano by Floor Peters.
Government grant helps leisure centres move towards net zero. Harpenden Leisure Centre is set to become more eco-friendly following a £173,000 government grant. St Albans City and District Council have secured the funds to install solar panels to reduce both bills and emissions. The money is provided by the National Lottery-supported Swimming Pool Support Fund. Steve Cox, Everyone Active, area contract manager, said, "We are delighted the council has been successful in obtaining funding, and it is great news that this project will further reduce the centre's carbon footprint. As a result of the energy crisis, we have seen our energy bills more than double. The implementation of the solar panels at Harpenden Leisure Centre marks a significant step towards reducing its carbon footprint and simultaneously lowering energy costs. Everyone Active is proud to work alongside the council as part of our net zero strategy to help achieve our company's net zero ambitions." The leisure centre, with nearly 4,000 members, opened just 3 years ago. The council, along with its leisure contractor, Everyone Active, is committed to achieving net zero target by 2030, although the panels alone won't make the centre self-sufficient. A contract for their purchase and installation will be put out to tender.
Police officer found not guilty of rape. Jury acquits officer after 3 week trial. A Hertfordshire police officer has been found not guilty of raping a woman at her home following a trial. David Stansbury, who was accused of sexually assaulting a woman in her home in Plymouth, Devon, was unanimously acquitted by the jury last Wednesday. Sergeant Stansbury denied 3 counts of rape between October the 23rd and November the 30th, 2009, in a trial that lasted 3 weeks. He was found not guilty after a jury deliberated for 6 hours and 48 minutes, with Sergeant Stansbury clearly emotional as he left the courtroom. Bristol Crown Court had heard that Sergeant Stansbury, who was an officer with Devon and Cornwall Police at the time, had been called to the woman's address and took her statement after a suspect had tried to smash her door in. The alleged victim said he returned to her home in the days following her original 999 call when she was drunk and had drugs in her home. The allegations against Sergeant Stansbury were made when the woman was in the back of a police van after being arrested at a disturbance in 2020. She told the officers she did not go to the police earlier because she was afraid that as a drug and alcohol user, her family would be taken away. Sergeant Stansbury told the court that he did not rape this woman and insisted he does not remember her or the attempted break-in at her home, saying his accuser had told a complete lie that's completely ruined my life. Hearts Police have confirmed that Stansbury had worked within the North Watford Safer Neighbourhood team. In his first 5 months, from late 2012, he covered Leggetts before swapping to Woodside.
Council leader to step down. Councillor reveals why he's not standing for election. St Albans City and District Council leader Chris White has opened up on his decision to step down ahead of May's local elections. Councillor White, the Liberal Democrat councillor for Clarence, has been involved in local politics for almost 31 years and has led the council since 2019. The 64-year-old admitted he had doubts over whether he could do another four-year stint in charge, especially after suffering from a serious illness earlier this year. By May, I will have been a councillor for 31 years, and there comes to a point when you grow older, he told the Hearts ad. I'm 64 now, and it comes to the point where you have to ask yourself, can I do another four-year stint? By then, I would be almost 70. I have been ill this year, and although I'm much better now, it comes as a bit of a warning. You suddenly realise you're not a youngster anymore. Reflecting on his time as leader, Councillor White continued, not everything has gone as well as we would have liked, but keeping this district council solvent, despite government cuts every year, is remarkable. Not all councils can do that. And it's not without its pain to those who have to pay more, myself included. Getting close to a workable local plan, as opposed to something that was never going to go through, is great. I am also proud of helping to modernise the council. When I started, St Albans was famous for its isolationism, whereas now, we're another Hertfordshire council. We get on well with our neighbours, they respect us, and we respect them, and together, we're doing much better things as a result. Councillor White admitted that his proudest achievement was declaring a climate emergency not long after he took over in 2019, something which he described as a really important thing for me and for everyone. He said, a lot of councils have done it, but we did it right back at the beginning, and we meant it. We've got more than 100 actions that stem from that, so that feels like a really important thing for me and for everyone. He admitted that not being part of the council would feel strange, but wished them continued success, adding, I obviously want them to be successful. It does feel strange saying them rather than we, but I'm not going to sit there and tell them, well, you did this wrong.
Help police pick new priorities. Hertfordshire Constabulary is requesting public input to help establish its new local policing priorities. Neighbourhood policing teams, MPTs, tackle long and short-term community issues such as antisocial behaviour, theft, speeding and drug-related crimes. Every 4 months, these priorities are set to focus on issues that are causing the most problems to residents. The public will see a dedicated team of PCs and PCSOs working on these priorities through increasing police presence, holding engagement events and targeted enforcement. The county is divided into 10 policing areas known as Community Safety Partnerships, CSPs, each covered by NPTs, but also policed by intervention officers who respond to emergency calls. The local crime unit, which investigates serious crimes like burglary, robbery and assault, and specialist units such as Operation Scorpion, which tackles acquisitive crime. Superintendent Anna Wright said, feedback from members of the public plays a big part in our decision-making and is used to help shape the priorities alongside an analysis of local data. We want to ensure that local policing resources are focusing on the issues that matter most, so I'd encourage everyone to share their views with us.
The publishers of the Hearts Advertiser have formed a partnership to support the NSPCC, one of our oldest charities. But what does it actually do? The NSPCC brings people together to end child abuse in the UK. Public donations make up around 90% of the charity's funding, ensuring it can continue to help children who have been abused to rebuild their lives, protect those at risk, and find ways of preventing abuse from ever happening. Its staff, volunteers, supporters and partners work together to be there for children in need of support and parents finding it tough. When laws need to change or governments need to do more, the charity aims to persevere until things improve. Volunteering, how you can get involved. Volunteers are vital to ensuring the NSPCC are there for children. Whether you can spare an hour or two, or want to get involved more often, the time you can give is invaluable. There is something for everyone. You could volunteer as a childline counsellor, lead workshops in schools to help keep children safe, help out at events or fundraise in your community. Visit nspcc.org.uk to explore our volunteering roles or download a fundraising pack. Worried about a child? If you're worried about a child's well-being or safety, you can contact the NSPCC helpline to talk to trained practitioners about your concerns. They can suggest local services, offer simple guidance, or make referrals to children's services and the police. If you think a child is in immediate danger, then call the police on 999 straight away. Children can contact Childline with any worry and talk to a counsellor online or on the phone.
Service helps son to speak out. A mother whose son was sexually abused by a family friend has praised an NSPCC programme that helped him talk about the abuse. Speak Out, Stay Safe, which the NSPCC has been running in primary schools across the UK since 2011, helps children understand abuse in all its forms and how to ask for help. As the charity rolls out a refreshed version of the programme and encourages more schools to sign up, an NSPCC supporter talks about how a visit to her son's school helped him speak about the abuse he was suffering. Caroline, not her real name, said, "When my son was younger, his behaviour suddenly began to deteriorate. He became aggressive and had really low self-esteem, and we couldn't understand what was wrong. After being involved in a Speak Out, Stay Safe assembly, he came home and disclosed to me that he had been sexually abused by a 13-year-old family friend when he was staying away from home. If it hadn't been for that assembly, I honestly think the abuse would still be happening. He was able to see clearly what was right and wrong, and then use the appropriate words to tell me that he wanted the abuse to stop. It's so important the assemblies continue and help to keep children safe from abuse." The programme, which was delivered to more than 1.2 million children across 5,332 schools last year, uses age-appropriate language, simple exercises, and videos. It includes a virtual assembly, lesson plans, and face-to-face workshops delivered by NSPCC volunteers. Janet Hinton, the NSPCC's strategic service manager for schools, said, "For many children, we know they might not be aware they are experiencing abuse, and some might be scared about speaking out in fear of repercussions. Through Speak Out, Stay Safe, we aim to let children know that abuse is never a child's fault, and that there are people who can help them. The programme is available in English and Welsh, and there are versions that incorporate British Sign Language and for children with additional needs and disabilities. To find out more, search online for NSPCC, Speak Out, Stay Safe."
Voters urge to register ahead of upcoming polls. Hertfordshire goes to the polls again on Thursday, May the 2nd, but only eligible registered voters can take part in the elections. Voters must also show an accepted form of photo ID if they want to have their say at the ballot box. Voters who are already registered do not need to register unless they have had a change of circumstances, such as a new house or a name change. Residents yet to register have until 11:59 p.m. on Tuesday, April the 16th, if they want to take part.
Local elections taking place in Hearts this year. Hertfordshire's next elections are less than a month away. From Abbots Langley to Widdiel, Tring to Turnford, eligible voters will go to the polls on Thursday, May the 2nd. A vote will take place for residents to choose who they want to become Hertfordshire's next police and crime commissioner. The candidate who secures the £78,400 a year job will be responsible for balancing police budgets, setting crime prevention objectives, and linking up the police with other organisations with a role in crime prevention and safety. There are also local elections taking place at 7 out of Hertfordshire's 10 district and borough councils. Eligible voters will receive polling cards through their door, which set out how many seats are up for election in their wards. What is a police and crime commissioner election? Hertfordshire has only ever had one police and crime commissioner, or PCC. Conservative incumbent David Lloyd became the first person to hold the title in 2012. He will retire in May, so a new PCC is guaranteed. Voters who took part in previous polls, including the last one in 2021, had two choices, a first choice and a second preference. But the government has scrapped this supplementary vote system, so voters must select only one option at this year's election. In 2024, the person with the most votes, the candidate first past the post, will win. Eligible voters throughout the county can take part, wherever they live in Hertfordshire. Whoever wins the election will be responsible for balancing the force's budget, setting crime prevention objectives, holding Hertfordshire Constabulary's chiefs to account, and attending the Police and Crime Panel, which is predominantly made up of local councillors. What is a local election? Voters in local elections choose who they want to represent them on councils. 159 district and borough council seats are due for election this year, save for any by-elections. Broxbourne, 10 out of 30 seats. North Hearts, 51 out of 51 seats. St Albans, including Harpenden, 18 out of 56 seats. Stevenage, 39 out of 39 seats. Three Rivers, 13 out of 39 seats. Watford, 12 out of 36 seats. Welin Hatfield, 16 out of 48 seats. Whole council polls took place in Decorum, East Harts and Hartsmere last year, so the next local elections in these districts are due in 2027. District and borough councils are responsible for household bin collections, some leisure centres and theatres, town centre regeneration, local planning policies, council housing, some car parks, some cemeteries, pest control and licences. All Hertfordshire County Council seats are up for election next year, in 2025. The countywide authority is responsible for local highways, buses, rubbish tips, schools, adult and children's social care, youth centres, trading standards, and Hertfordshire Fire and Rescue Service. Parish and town council election timetables vary.
Headliners announced for Comedy Garden: Harry Hill, Josh Widdicombe, Ross Noble and Joe Brand are among the comedians announced for this year's St Albans Comedy Garden. The popular event is back for 2024 and will take place from July 24th to 28th in Verulamium Park, with some of the biggest names in comedy set to appear. Harry Hill, Last Legs, Josh Widdicombe, Ross Noble, National Treasure Joe Brand, former Mock the Week host Dara O'Brien, Simon Amstel and Fern Brady are all on a jam-packed bill. They will be joined by the likes of Tim Key, Henning Wynn, David O'Doherty, Reginald D. Hunter, John Cairns, John Robbins, Laura Smythe, Lou Sanders and Mike Wozniak for 5 days of non-stop laughter. Since bursting onto the scene with a sellout series of shows in summer 2021, the Comedy Garden, produced by sibling team Will Briggs and Cass Randolph of 57 Festivals, has become increasingly popular. The pair are excited to announce this year's festival, with Will saying, "We're thrilled with this year's lineup. To have so many of our favourite acts across 5 days is a real treat, and we can't wait to get back to Verulamium Park. We've had 3 incredible years so far in St Albans. There's a really big appetite for laughs and good times here," Cass continued. "The St Albans audiences are always really up for it, and the previous year's shows have been a riot. We feel really established now. Our audience know they're guaranteed an incredible set of comedians with each show, plus the added festival fun of great bars and street food. Often people buy tickets to see one act they love and are introduced to more incredible comedians while with us. This festival really is the ultimate showcase to catch the best stand-up talent right now." Tickets for St Albans Comedy Garden are on sale now, and you can find out more by visiting www.stalbanscomedygarden.co.uk. And there's a picture of Harry Hill and Josh Widdicombe, with Harry Hill and Josh Widdicombe are coming to St Albans Comedy Garden in July.
History Society to hold Museum Open Day. Harpenden and District Local History Society is marking its 50th anniversary with an open day and the official opening of the town's new museum. The open day will take place from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Saturday, April the 20th, at the Eric Morecambe Centre. Visitors can enjoy exhibitions on the history of Harpenden and the district, displays from town societies, a children's competition, and history talks for adults and children. The event will be presided over by Annie Brewster, High Sheriff of Hertfordshire, in nomination. Entry to the museum is free, and both members and non-members are welcome, with no booking required. The Society's aims are to educate the public in the local history of Harpenden and district, and to make a valuable contribution to the cultural life of Harpenden. Harpenden Museum, which is situated on the lower floor of the Eric Morecambe Centre, was made possible thanks to a bequest from the late Les Casey. The museum is open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on Tuesdays, Thursdays and Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and at other times by appointment. Among the collections are artefacts, documents, photos and artwork reflecting Harpenden's history from an early settlement to a commuter town.
Robin Hood's Camera Win. St Albans has more than 50 pubs offering a bountiful choice of fine beers, and it needs exceptional skill and dedication for one pub to stand out from the crowd. So many congratulations to Jim and Liz Pratt, landlords of the Robin Hood, who have won 2 prestigious awards from the local branch of Camera, Pub of the Year and Cider Pub of the Year. They are seen receiving their awards from Ian Boyd, chairman of the South Hearts branch of the Campaign for Real Ale, in a photograph next to this article. As well as a large range of ciders, the Robin Hood's hand pumps serve excellent cask beer, and it's a rare outlet for the superb Sussex Best Bitter from Harveys of Lewes. The pub at 126 Victoria Street has a fascinating history. Jim told me it was originally owned by a St Albans brewery called Adie and White, and when it was first built, it was surrounded by open land. Today there are houses and shops all around, including a branch of Iceland, and the pub is popular with commuters from London in search of a quick pint at the end of the working day. Adie and White was a substantial brewery based in Checker Street. The brewery was founded by the Kinder family in 1737, who added a maltings, using top-quality barley from Hertfordshire and Cambridgeshire. The maltings gave its name to the modern shopping centre. The brewery was bought by Stephen Adie and Samuel Monckton White in 1868. They busily expanded the business, buying Parsons Brewery in St. Peter Street in 1885, and the last remaining competitor in the city, T.W. Kent & Son, in 1918. Adie and White developed a large range of beer, including bitter ale, dinner ale, single stout, double stout, porter, AK, and KKK stock ale. The letter K, along with X, was used as cask branding to indicate strength. AK was a mild ale, while KKK was a strong beer used for blending. McMullen in Hartford still uses AK as the name of its mild ale. Adie and White built a substantial estate of 56 pubs. As well as the Robin Hood, the A&W pubs that survive today include the Beehive, Fleur de Lis, now called the Snug, Goat, Lower Red Lion, Mermaid, Portland Arms, and the Peacock. A member of the brewing staff, Jack Knight, recalled that A&W had a sign depicting the famous cricketer Dr. W.G. Grace of Victorian and Edwardian times. The cricketing theme continued with the Bat and Ball pub on Checker Street. The brewery was bought in 1936 by J.W. Green of Luton and was promptly closed. The aggressive Luton brewery wanted A&W pubs to stock its own beers. Green dated back from 1897, and it changed its name to Flowers in 1954 when it bought Flowers Brewery in Stratford-on-Avon. The head brewer at Luton, Bernard Dixon, achieved fame in 1955 when he produced one of the first, possibly the very first, keg beers. Unlike cask-conditioned real ale, keg beer is filtered, pasteurised and artificially carbonated. Most importantly, it has a long shelf life, while cask ale in contrast has to be sold within just a few days or it will oxidise. The profits from keg beer were not lost on bigger brewers, and Green's was bought by Whitbread in 1961. The London brewer closed the Luton plant in 1969, but continued to brew and market Flowers Keg as a leading national brand. The Robin Hood, in common with several St. Albans pubs, was a Whitbread tied house for many years. But Whitbread left brewing in 2000, and the Robin Hood is now owned by the Stonegate Pub Company that allows Jim and Liz to stock an excellent range of cask beers that has won them their well-deserved award, the Camra Award.
Believing every day is special. If Quakers don't celebrate Easter, do you not take the long weekend then? It's a question that can be asked. St. Albans is a very fascinating place for a number of reasons, but the origins of the clock tower I find especially interesting. It was originally raised as a challenge to the power of the abbey from a people wanting to set their own hours and not be controlled by the dean. The long weekends and many of the celebrations of Easter are as much cultural as religious. Clock tower as much as abbey. Quakers have always been torn between the two, people of faith, but also people of the people, religious or not. While we may not celebrate religious feasts, we do celebrate many cultural ones, and a long Easter weekend is a cultural aspect, part of living in the UK. And of course, they do involve chocolate, which is something Quakers have been involved in for a very long time. John Cadbury, who founded Cadbury's Chocolate in the 19th century, was a Quaker. So we don't celebrate Easter as such, as we do believe that no days are special, because all days are special. We don't hold the Easter weekend, or Christmas celebrations for that matter, as a special time. However, we do celebrate the truth of Easter weekend. Every meeting, every day, those of us who are Christian in our Quakerism are celebrating the sacrifice and the rising of Jesus. Holding that no Sundays are special, no feasts or celebrations is not a negative approach, And it isn't a rejection of those who do celebrate these occasions. Rather, it is an attempt to ensure that we are the same person in meeting on Sunday as we are in work on Monday, to express the truth that each day we are called to be who we are meant to be. And in this, we both gain and lose something. I do think we can lose a sense of rhythm to the year that is a part of some places, and we can also lose a sense of rhythm of the week as well, without a day being considered special. But we do gain a whole life perspective to our faith that is, for me, a real benefit.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
This is Gilly with a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights, starting with programmes that are broadcast at the same time each day. In the essay Renewing the Past, the BBC and Early Music, former Radio 3 controller and proms director Nicholas Kenyon delves into the archives to explore the BBC's role in reviving music from before the 18th century. At 9:45 p.m. on Radio 3. And Book at Bedtime continues Paul Lynch's Booker Prize-winning novel about Ireland, Prophet Song, at 10:45 on Radio 4. Back to Saturday, 13th of April. Opera on 3 presents Aleko and Francesca da Rimini, two rarely heard one-act Rachmaninoff operas, in a performance recorded in January in Munich. Both feature torrid love triangles, culminating in a double murder, at 6 p.m. on Radio 3. In the documentary Forward Thinking, astronomer Jocelyn Bell Burnell advocates for change in science. In 1967, she discovered a previously unknown kind of star, the pulsar. Currently Professor of Astrophysics at Oxford, she calls for a more globally inclusive vision for exploring the cosmos, especially as India and China have space programmes, while Japan and South Africa collaborate with international partners for their own low-key missions. At 7:05 p.m. on the BBC World Service. Archive on 4 celebrates the history of the 7-inch single in 7 Inches of Joy, the single at 75. Petula Clark and John Layton join Pete Waterman, remembering the early years as recording artists in the 1950s, the rock and roll and beat generation, the birth of teenage culture, and the British invasion of the US pop charts, at 8 p.m. on Radio 4. On to Sunday, 14th of April. Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions this week is leading forensic scientist Professor Lady Sue Black. The Foreign Office and the UN have called on her to give evidence in countless high-profile investigations. Currently the president of St John's College, Oxford, she has been a House of Lords crossbench peer since 2021. At 12 noon on Radio 3. Haiti, Descent into Anarchy, is a documentary presented by award-winning journalist Mike Thompson, who has covered events there on several occasions. One of the world's poorest countries, it has no functioning government and gangs control the streets of the capital, Port-au-Prince. Over the past 60 years, its people have lived through dictatorships, military coups, earthquakes, hurricanes, cholera outbreaks and political instability. At 1:30 p.m. on Radio 4, repeated Monday at 4 p.m. The afternoon drama today is a two-part adaptation of Rosamund Pilcher's novel The Shell Seekers. When the adult children of Penelope find that a beloved painting by their grandfather is worth a fortune, they quickly form ideas about what to do with their heirloom. meanwhile their mother, reflects on the events of her life in search of an answer. At 3 p.m. on Radio 4. Next, Monday the 15th of April. And another afternoon drama, The Flowers Are Perfect in the Garden, one of a trio of plays by Lucy Caldwell about goodbyes. A man spends his final days in a hospice, surrounded by his wife and once estranged children, who share heartwarming memories of years gone by. Starring Dermot Crowley and Dearbler Malloy, at 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Following this, Great Lives features Gaudi, the Spanish architect most famous for the extraordinary Basilica Sagrada Familia in Barcelona. He is nominated by conservative peer Ros Altman, who explores his life and how his Catholicism and love of Catalan nature informed his work, at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. And in History's Secret Heroes, Helena Bonham Carter shines a light on thrill-seeker Christine Granville, the spy who skied in from the cold. During World War II, she offered to ski across enemy lines and over the deadly Carpathian Mountains into Nazi-occupied Poland to gather intelligence for the British. Churchill would later call her his favourite spy. At 3:30 on Radio 4. Now, Tuesday the 16th of April. First, Inside Health. Scientists say ticks are starting to pose more of a health risk here in the UK as our climate warms and urban areas spill into green spaces. James Callagher goes on the tick hunt in Richmond Park. He also looks into the science of measles. What is it about this virus that has made it the most infectious in the world? At 9:30 a.m. on Radio 4. Sophie Okonedo and Mark Rylance star in the four-part drama beginning this afternoon. Song of the Reed by Steve Waters follows a year in the life of Flegwick, a fictional wetlands nature reserve. The site was not financially sustainable when its founder passed away, so his daughter Liv needs to find a way for it to survive. But Warden Ian doesn't hold with ideas about trendy conservation. At 2:15 p.m. on Radio 4. Fans of Milton Jones will welcome the start of a new six-part series of Thanks a Lot, Milton Jones. In Apple is the New Black, Milton ends up in prison for committing a true crime podcast. At 6 p.m. on Radio 4. Repeated next Tuesday on Radio 4 Extra. And don't forget, In Touch, with news and information for the blind and partially sighted, at 8:40 p.m. on Radio 4. Now, Wednesday 17th of April. Fans of Thor Ahurd are in for a treat with an episode from the 1981 hit comedy series Never Too Late, thought lost forever but now restored. She plays an OAP determined not to give up on the pleasures of life. At 7 a.m, 12 noon and 6 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Batgirls is a new three-part afternoon drama series. Naylor's story is about a bright teenager who loves cricket and joins a school female team, but her parents worry it will distract her from her studies. On Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert celebrates 50 years of the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra with the work they sang in their very first concert, Berlioz's opera The Damnation of Faust, in a concert performance recorded last Saturday at Symphony Hall, Birmingham. At 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. Coming to Thursday, 18th of April. The subject of In Our Time this week is Napoleon's 100 Days. Melvin Bragg and guests discuss the period between Napoleon's return from exile on the island of Elba to Paris on the 20th of March 1815, and the second restoration of King Louis XVII on the 8th of July 1815, at 9 a.m. on Radio 4, repeated Sunday at 11 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert comes live from the City Halls, Glasgow, with the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Ryan Wigglesworth and pianist Stephen Huff, in a programme of music by Rachmaninoff, Stravinsky and Hans Abrahamson, at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. Why do we kiss? Is this week's topic in the series of Why Do We Do That? Ella Al-Shamahi and guests discuss the strangeness of kissing, a custom that only exists in 46% of cultures in the world, and how kissing has been shown to give away clues about your genetic information via smells. At 9:45 p.m. on Radio 4, repeated Sunday at 7:45 p.m. Lastly, we come to Friday, the 19th of April. In Antisocial, Adam Fleming investigates one of the issues of the day, taking something that's being fiercely debated across social media, blogs, talk shows and phone-ins, and slowing down the debate to give listeners a better understanding of what the heat is all about. At 12:04 p.m. on Radio 4, repeated Wednesday at 8 p.m. Fans of the Now show may be aware, but just in case, after 64 series, Steve Punt and Hugh Dennis present the very last episode of the topical comedy programme, taking a look back at some of the most memorable moments of the last 25 years. At 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4, repeated Saturday at 12:30 p.m. And finally, settling into its new home on Radio 3, Friday Night is Music Night comes from the Shenzhen Concert Hall, Guangdong, one of the dates on a Chinese tour taken by the BBC Concert Orchestra last New Year, with an eclectic programme of popular works from James Bond to Johann Strauss II, at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. Happy listening.
Hello, this is Helen from Wharfdale Talking News with Val's selection of audio-described TV programmes starting Saturday the 13th of April to Friday the 19th of April 2024. There are quite a few new series starting this week, so I hope you can find something that might interest you. We start with Saturday the 13th of April. Mary prepares some of her own family favourites in today's Mary Berry Simple Comforts on BBC One at 11:30 a.m. If you fancy a flutter on the horses today, you might be interested in a visit to Aintree. The races start at 1:20, with the Grand National at 4 p.m. on ITV1. In Queensferry, an American visitor is caught out by the tide. Saving Lives at Sea is on BBC Two at 7 p.m. On a mission to reveal the hidden treasures of Estonia, Professor Bettany Hughes explores a sacred burial site on the island of Saare Maa. Bettany Hughes' Treasures of the World is on Channel 4 at 7 p.m. In this week's episode of the hospital drama, Teddy is horrified when he is confronted by an unwelcome visitor. Casualty is on BBC One at 8:35 p.m. How about a visit to one of my favourite parts of Yorkshire as you visit the Barraclughs of Dalehead Farm as they raise Swaledale and Cheviot sheep? Narrated by Toby Jones, the North York Moors, A Wild Year is on BBC Two at 9 p.m. The mystery bomber is still wreaking explosive havoc. Meanwhile, Professor Kathy Torrance gets into a tricky situation with her PhD student. The drama, Traces, is on BBC One at 9:25 p.m. Now on to Sunday the 14th of April. Sunday with Laura Koonsberg, featuring interviews with politicians and key public figures, is on BBC One at 9 a.m. off the coast of New Zealand, false killer whales and bottlenose dolphins search for food in unison in tonight's episode of the nature documentary Mammals on BBC One at 7 p.m. Biscuit bars, custard slices and novelty cakes are among the tasks facing the celebrities in the series finale of The Great Celebrity Bake Off for Stand Up to Cancer on Channel 4 at 7:40 p.m. A treat for Midsummer fans, a new series starts tonight. The body of a survivalist is discovered inside his own bomb-proof shelter, and DCI Barnaby uncovers a dark conspiracy that proves just how far some people will go to escape the end of the world. Midsummer Murders is on ITV1 at 8 p.m. Jeannie finds a warehouse where the band start to rehearse and forge their own identity. Gregory schemes to keep his brother and Barden safe. The drama, This Town, is on BBC One at 9 p.m. The Radio Times Film of the Day is the Oscar-winning documentary about climber Alex Honnold's preparations to conquer the formidable El Capitan rock formation in California's Yosemite National Park, without ropes or safety equipment. Free Solo is on BBC Two at 10 p.m. Here are those programmes which are on at the same time throughout the week. Homes Under the Hammer is at 11:15, Bargain Hunt is at 12:15, Doctors is at 1:45 but not on Friday, and Escape to the Country is at 3 p.m. All these programmes are on BBC One. On BBC Two, we have The Edible Garden at 2:30 p.m, Jay and Dom's Home Fix at 3 p.m, and Great Australian Railway Journeys at 7 p.m, but not on Friday. There are two episodes of Heartbeat on ITV Three at 5:55 and 6:55, Monday to Friday. Let's see what's on offer for Monday the 15th of April. Jamie Oliver presents innovative ways to get the most out of an air fryer, from quick snacks to full-blown meals. Jamie's Air Fryer Meals is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. Several new series for you tonight, all at 9 p.m. We see the return of the crime drama set in Belfast. A year into the job, the team are faced with a drug-fueled crime wave that leads them into a loyalist estate. Blue Lights is on BBC One at 9. There is a new three-part documentary series following the most extensive archaeological excavation in Pompeii for a generation. Fresco-inspired animations show the realities of life there and the horror faced by residents as Vesuvius erupted in AD 79. Pompeii, The New Dig is on BBC Two at 9. In the first of another three-part documentary series, Martin Clunes travels to Papua New Guinea and visits the Trobriand Islands, where villagers have built a house for him to live in during his stay. Martin Clunes, Islands of the Pacific, is on ITV One at 9. Over on Channel 4, there is a new series following police and digital forensics experts as they use digital technology to solve crimes. Murder Case, The Digital Detectives, is on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Moving on to Tuesday, the 16th of April. The remaining designers pair up and head to East Grinstead in West Sussex to transform the look of two shops. Interior Design Masters with Alan Carr is on BBC One at 8 p.m. Alison Hammond follows in the footsteps of the late Paul O'Grady as she heads behind the scenes at Battersea Dogs Home. For the Love of Dogs with Alison Hammond is on ITV One at 8 p.m. A new comedy created and starring Alan Carr starts tonight. Young Alan considers following in his father's footsteps and becoming a footballer. Changing Ends is on ITV One at 8:30 p.m. A new group of amateur chefs compete for a MasterChef apron as they face the challenge of making their own brunch dish and creating a two-course menu in 1 hour and 15 minutes. MasterChef is on BBC One at 9 p.m. With traditional gender roles a thing of the past, Danny Dyer travels the country to explore modern masculinity. Danny Dyer, How to Be a Man, is on Channel 4 at 10 p.m. The final episode is at the same time tomorrow. On to Wednesday the 17th of April. The team tackle an old miner's lamp that saved its owner's life and a rug-covered armchair in the repair shop at 8 p.m. on BBC One. Andy organises a festival with a spectacular feast at its centre to celebrate the achievements of two artists who run a community arts project in a deprived neighbourhood of Stoke-on-Trent. Andy Oliver's Fabulous Feasts is on BBC Two at 8 p.m. The race to Lombok is well underway and 5 hours separate the teams. Leaving Japan, they must cross their first border into South Korea to reach the next checkpoint. Race Across the World is on BBC One at 9 p.m. Out of prison, Jasper is desperate to get back to his work at the university. Professor T is on ITV One at 9 p.m. Joe and Daryl's dream has turned into a nightmare as building inspectors condemned the work on their Seaview home, but Stacey shows them how they can save money by taking on jobs themselves. You can see the results in Stacey Solomon's Renovation Rescue on Channel 4 at 9 p.m. Thursday the 18th of April. John and Greg task the contenders with taking an everyday ingredient from basic to brilliant in tonight's MasterChef at 8 p.m. on BBC One. Another new series starts tonight. The dedicated team at South Essex Wildlife Hospital work to save the lives of sick animals and return them to the wild. In tonight's programme, they treat a fox, a seal pup and a swan. Wildlife Rescue is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. Claire's father, Nathan, is questioned about the methods he employed to track his daughter's movements as he takes to the stand in the drama The 12 at 9 p.m. on ITV One. Now for a documentary which explores the remarkable life of one of the world's most celebrated statesmen, Nelson Mandela, A Life in 10 Pictures, is on BBC Two at 10 p.m. Finally, we come to Friday the 19th of April. Paul Merton explores the upper reaches of the Tay, beginning with a microlight flight over the river's source. Grand Tours of Scotland's Rivers is on BBC Two at 7 p.m. When a woman is shot with a bow and arrow in broad daylight, the suspects include an environmental activist and an unscrupulous land developer. But the team learn of a feud between the victim and her brother-in-law. The drama Beyond Paradise is on BBC One at 8 p.m. Another chance to join the comedian and musician Bill Bailey as he travels across the vast state of Western Australia. Bill Bailey's Australian Adventure is on Channel 4 at 8 p.m. The jurors are taken to Kate's house to witness a demonstration of the Crown's theory, but it ends in disaster for the defence. The 12 is on ITV One at 9 p.m. We end the week with a comedy film. After Lillian announces her engagement, she asks her lifelong pal Annie to be maid of honour, but Annie's life is in a mess and she loses control over the bachelorette party to Lillian's seemingly perfect new friend Helen. Bridesmaids is on ITV2 at 9 p.m.
TNF Soundings.
Rupert Evershed provided us with his fascinating nature notes for several years, but his ability to observe nature was somewhat curtailed during lockdown. Here is the April 2021 edition, written during that time.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly nature notes for the Hearts Advertiser. Highlights of a locked down year. A year of being forced to concentrate almost entirely on the wildlife on my doorstep has taken its toll on me, but in a good way, I believe. Spending protracted periods of time before breakfast, during lunch, or at the end of the day just sitting in the garden to see what happens is now part and parcel of my week. Sometimes not much happens, sometimes the same thing as yesterday happens, but every now and then something extraordinary happens, and never does nothing happen. Just the other day, as I sat sipping tea outside, a bird came over the fence to my left, tore past my head and dived over the next fence, continuing on over the neighbouring gardens. In what has become a reflex action, I got my binoculars to my eyes just before it vanished, revealing it not to be the wood pigeon I had thought, but a woodcock. A first for my garden and totally unexpected. Another quirky habit I've developed over the last year is to sit out in the garden after dark and listen, maybe for a couple of hours before bed. As a result, I've learned quite a few things. One is simply that we, as humans, make an incredible amount of noise, and that noise is of a very dominating quality. Unlike the broken stanzas of a robin's song, or the many different calls of birds as they fly around, our noise, mostly cars and trains, tends to be continuous and unbroken. It leaves me wondering how this affects wildlife that would normally be able to listen without the background roar. I've also learned that another world awakes as ours goes to sleep. Birds that would never be seen or heard over the garden during the daylight hours take their chances at night. Moorhens and coots from the nearby golf course lake take up nightly patrol flights, their plaintive and repetitive calls tracking their circuits. This last weekend I heard the strangled squeal of their cousin, the water rail, accompanied by a moorhen as they flew, presumably quite close together, overhead. It is a world I cannot see, but at times can be quite busy. Of course, there are plenty of unidentified squeaks and calls, and maybe in time I will learn what those are, but for now, just simply recognising a bird call in the dark is exciting. Without the benefit of sight, the calls are always unexpected, and sometimes so loud they make you jump. One such bird recently was a flyover oyster catcher heading over the garden, and its loud pleep calls were subsequently heard by a friend further north in St. Albans. This unseen world has prompted me to invest in a recording device so that I can review the night sounds the next day using audio software on my computer. It has been fascinating to see the calls of various birds, not to mention police sirens and car horns, translated onto a spectrogram in full colour. The highest frequencies are the domain of our local pipistrelle bats, creating sharp little spikes on the graph, while migrating redwings' thin seep calls appear as bolder vertical streaks further down the frequency range. I take great delight in the fact that, though I cannot see them, the birds and bats are there, and visible on the spectrograms with their own unique spectrum of frequencies. For me, the spectrograms provide a fitting picture for the past year, for although we have not been physically in the dark, we have nonetheless been greatly limited, unable to go and see the wider world we're used to. Instead, our graph has been coloured by the activities of our local wildlife, the rhythms of nature on our doorstep, and the comings and goings of all its inhabitants. The joy of these local discoveries have provided little spikes of colour and life, as bold and bright as any spectrogram, and given vital windows out to the wider world. As this spring brings hope of renewed freedoms, for me the call of the oyster catcher over the garden in the dark and the brief explosion of a woodcock over the fences will stay with me as treasured moments wherever I go.
A quiz now on TV, films and sport. Starting with number one. My name's Roger Brooks. What was the name of the first Doctor Who actor? The name of the actor who first played Doctor Who. Question two. Who played the maid, Polly, in the hugely successful TV series Fawlty Towers? Who played Polly the maid? And what was her other connection with that series? Question three. In what year did the film Titanic win 11 Oscars? Was it 1985, 1975, 1998, or 1978? Question 4. Who were the colossal at the time and legendary ever since stars of the Western High Noon? Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling. The two leads in that, the male and the female. Question 5, still on films. Who played Lawrence of Arabia? Lawrence of Arabia. Question 6. Can you name Daniel Craig's first and last James Bond films? Craig's first and his last James Bond film. The last one being after he said he'd rather slit his throat than play James Bond again. Guess money talks. Question 7. Can you name the series in which Roger Moore starred with Tony Curtis as two avenging, happy-go-lucky, crime-busting people, Roger Moore and Tony Curtis. Question 8. A very famous actor was actually born with the name Marion Morrison. He, get it? He changed his name to what from Marion Morrison? Question 9. Sport. Which football team plays at Craven Cottage? That's our 9. Give it some thought. OK, the answers to our TV, film and sport quiz, starting with number 1. The first Doctor Who was William Hartnell. Question 2. Who played Polly the maid in Fawlty Towers? That was Connie Booth, who at the time was Mrs. John Cleese. Question 3. Titanic won its 11 Oscars in 1998. Question 4. The male and female stars of High Noon were Gary Cooper and, before she was Princess, Grace Kelly. Grace Kelly. Question 5. Who played Lawrence in Lawrence of Arabia? That was Peter O'Toole. Peter O'Toole. Question 6. Daniel Craig's first James Bond film was Casino Royale, and his last was No Time to Die. Sounds like a Cockney. It means he's in a hurry, doesn't it? I've got no time to die. It was called No Time to Die. Question 7. The series that Roger Moore and Tony Curtis played playboy do-gooders was The Persuaders. The Persuaders. And the He-Man actor who changed his name from Marion Morrison was John Wayne, the Duke. John Wayne. And finally, question 9 on sport, this one. Who plays at Craven Cottage? And that is Fulham. Fulham. Hope you did well.
TNS Soundings.
Hello, everyone. This is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Julian, and here he is.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to 10 Today, broadcast number 8. This is a short 10-minute physical activity routine which will get you moving and stretching. It's great for your health, including improving your balance and building up your strength. Just take it at your own pace. There are plenty of options. If an exercise feels too much, just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either standing up or sitting down, so just do whatever feels good for you today. We want you all to do this exercise safely. You are responsible for monitoring how you are feeling throughout the session. If you feel any discomfort or pain, for example if you feel unwell or dizzy or experience palpitations, then please stop and seek medical advice. If remaining seated, at least to begin with, it would be ideal if you can use a hard chair so you can sit upright. It could be a dining chair, preferably without arms, which can get in the way of some exercises, and have your feet flat on the floor. OK, if you're stood up, just step your feet hip-width apart, relax your shoulders and stand up nice and tall, and take a couple of deep breaths. If you're sitting down, place both feet firmly on the floor. Keep your back straight, relax your shoulders, and take a couple of deep breaths in and out. In and out. So, first up, we have lift and lower. And remember, all the movements can be achieved whether you're sitting or standing. Raise both your arms straight up together with your palms up. Now raise up on your toes, then lower your toes back down, bringing your arms down at the same time. Then bend over gently without straining your back, and with your arms and legs straight if standing, or feet flat on the floor with your knees bent if sitting. Swing your arms from side to side twice, and come back to stand or sit up straight and take a breath. Now we're going to repeat that routine. So raise both arms straight up together with palms up. Raise up on your toes, then lower your toes back down, bringing your arms down at the same time. Then lean over gently, keeping legs and arms straight if standing, and feet flat on the floor and knees bent if sitting, and swing both arms from left to right twice, and return to standing position. So keep going, lifting up and down, then bending over and swinging. Great work, everyone. This is a nice one just to get all those muscles nice and warm. Next up is straight out. So for this one, if you're standing, you might want to make sure you're near a chair for balance. And whether you're sitting or standing, please do not raise legs higher than hip level. Keeping your left leg soft, bend your right leg and lift your knee level to hip height. Now gently stretch out your right leg as straight as you can without straining. Then bend knee again and return your foot to the start position. Now do the same on the other side, bending your left leg and lifting your knee level to hip height. Now stretch out your left leg as straight as you can without straining, and then bend your knee again and return to the start position. Keep doing this on alternate legs, lifting knee up to hip height, stretching leg out, and returning to the start position. This is a great one for working out those legs. The next one is called crunch for core. Bend your right arm and bring your right elbow towards your left knee, lifting the knee to reach your elbow. You should feel a nice crunch in your core, then release back down. If you're sitting and find it harder to lift the knee, bend your back and lean into it. Or if that's uncomfortable, then you can tap your knee with your hand instead. Now do the same on the other side. So bend your left arm and bring your left elbow towards your right knee, or tap your hand on your knee and release. Whichever variation you're doing, you should feel that crunch in your core. Keep going on alternate sides. Just a few more now. This is great workout for your tummy. We should all be feeling nice and warm now. The next one is called out and over. If you're standing, I recommend you're near something that you can hold onto for balance, like a chair. So raise your right leg out straight in front of you. Then keep your leg straight and move it gently to the right side until you feel that nice stretch in the top of your leg. Then move it back to the center and back down. Repeat this on the same leg. So raise your right leg out straight in front of you, then keep your leg straight and gently move it to the right side, feeling that nice stretch. Then move your leg back to the center and back down. So raise straight out, to the side, back straight, and back down. And again, do that a couple more times. This is really good for your hips, tummy, and thighs. Now, we're going to do the same on your left leg. So you raise your left leg out straight, and gently move it to the left side until you feel that nice stretch in the top of your leg. Then move it back to the center, and back down, remembering to keep that leg straight. So up, to the side, back straight, and back down. A couple more times on this side now. Great work, everyone. Next up is full circle. Stand up nice and tall and keep your back straight. Raise both arms straight up above your head, and then sweep them round together to the right, making one big circle all the way back up to the top. And keep going, swinging one big circle to the right, just a couple more on this direction. Now lower your hands, relax your shoulders and take a breath. Good work. Now we're going to do exactly the same, but in the opposite direction. So keep making those nice big circles. It's a great workout for your shoulders, this one. Now we have push up to moon. So keep your legs nice and soft. And if you're sitting, keep your feet nice and firmly on the ground. Bend your arms so both hands are at chest height. Then push both your hands together up in the air on your right, like you're pushing up to the moon. Then sweep your hands back down, front of your tummy, and to the left, pushing both your hands up to the air again on your left. And now keep going, so you're just making a nice big U with your hands, pushing up to the moon on either side. Just a couple more now. Really nice movement, this one. Next up is Slowly Does It. These are slightly different if you're sitting or standing. So if you're standing, keep your back straight, bend at your knees slightly to your halfway point, and hold. And then bend your knees all the way down to your lowest point, and hold. And then straighten up your legs again. Remember to keep your feet facing forward, and try not to let your knees move in front of your toes. So you're just moving halfway, holding, moving down to your lowest point, holding, and then coming back up. Keep going. If you're sitting, just straighten out your right leg right in front of you and hold briefly, feeling that nice stretch down your leg. Then return your foot to the floor and repeat on the other side. Whichever variation you're doing, you're working your legs. If you're standing, you're also working your bottom. Okay, so keep going, always remembering to keep your back straight. So for those standing, bending knees down to your halfway point and hold. Then down to your lowest point and hold, and then up. And sitting, raising your alternate legs and holding briefly. Good job, everyone. Next up is Swing Back. If you're standing, keep your legs straight. If you're sitting, keep your feet flat on the floor, bend your arms so both hands are at chest height, then straighten out your right arm and gently swing it back so you feel a nice rotation in your back. Looking towards your right hand, just take it as far as you feel comfortable, then return to the center and straighten out your left arm and gently swing it back, looking towards your left hand, and repeat. Feet and hips facing forward. You're just moving side to side, swinging your arms back nice and gently, feeling your back rotate as you move side to side. Just a couple more now. This is a great one for trunk rotation. Our last exercise today is Strike of the Cobra, a wee bit of martial arts. So if you're standing or sitting, keep your back straight, maintain a strong stance and clench your fists at chest height, like you're a boxer. Then with your right hand, punch arm straight out and return. And then punch upwards towards the left-hand corner of the ceiling, so your arm crosses over your body and return. Now do the same with your left hand. So punching straight forward, then punching upwards across the body towards the right. And keep going. Really think about how your muscles are responding here, making the punches slow and controlled. Just a couple more now. Good job. Now we really should all be feeling warm. If you're a little out of breath, that's a good thing. It means you've been working. If you're not a little out of breath, can you work a little harder next time? Anyway, nearly finished. We'll just finish off with a nice stretch and cool down. So we're going to start with a hamstring stretch. So step forward with your right foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Then bend your left leg and put your hands on your hips and just lean forward gently. Whether you're sitting or standing, you should feel a nice stretch down the back of your leg. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Then return to a standing up position and swap your legs. So this time, step forward with your left foot, placing your foot out in front of you with your foot flat on the floor. Then bend your right leg and just lean forward gently. Again, feeling that nice long stretch. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. And the final stretch, hugging a tree. Just hold your arms out in front of you, just like you are hugging a tree directly in front of you. And your arms form a nice circle in front of you. And then cup your hands, putting one hand in front of the other. Push your hands together, feeling that nice stretch across your shoulders and arms. Hold for 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. Now sit up or stand up and return to that nice relaxed posture we had at the beginning. Brilliant. So that was all the exercises, and we hope you enjoyed them. Just to finish off, shake it out. Just shake those arms and hands and then legs and feet. Great work, everyone. Doing 10 today just 3 times a week can have great health benefits. It's fun. You'll simply feel better. So do keep going. Thank you for listening.
We now move on to our regular Events This Week in History item, read for us by Penny.
Hello, this is Penny, and here are some notable events which have happened this week in the past. On the 14th of April 1865, President Abraham Lincoln was shot in the head by John Wilkes Booth at Ford's Theatre in Washington, D.C. Lincoln died the next morning. Booth, a well-regarded actor who was particularly popular in the South before the outbreak of the American Civil War, shouted, "Sic temper tyrannis, ever thus to tyrants." The South is avenged, as he jumped onto the stage. Despite breaking his leg in the fall, he was able to avoid capture and escape on horseback. Booth was finally discovered hiding in a barn on 26th of April, and although he was given the option to surrender before it was set alight, he chose to remain in the barn as it went up in flames. Booth was shot and killed in the burning barn by corporate Boston Corbett. On the 7th of July, his co-conspirators in the assassination were tried and hanged in Washington. On the 15th of April 2013, 3 people were killed and more than 260 others were wounded as 2 backpacks containing pressure cooker bombs left by brothers Zucker and Tamerlan Zarnev exploded near the finish line of the Boston Marathon. The FBI launched a massive manhunt that resulted in the shutdown of much of the Boston area, and 4 days later, 19-year-old Zucker was captured by the police. His older brother, 26-year-old Tamerlan, was killed following a shootout with police earlier that same day. Investigators believe that the Zarnovs were motivated by extremist Islamic beliefs, but planned and carried out the bombings on their own and were not connected to any terrorist organizations. In January 2015, Zucker Zarnev was found guilty of 30 federal charges, including the use of a weapon of mass destruction. He was sentenced to death, but appealed the decision. He is currently being held at a supermax prison in Colorado. On the 16th of April 1912, aviator Harriet Quimby became the first woman to fly across the English Channel, guiding her monoplane from Dover to Hardelot in France. The 25-mile flight across the Channel lasted 59 minutes, but sadly her accomplishment received little media attention, as the sinking of the Titanic the day before riveted the attention of the public and filled the newspapers. Although she died in a flying accident a few months later, aged just 37, Quimby's legacy as one of the most influential women in aviation was assured. On the 17th of April 1960, singer Eddie Cochran, the man behind Summertime Blues and Come On Everybody, was killed in a car crash in Chippenham in Wiltshire at the age of just 21. Cochran was travelling in a taxi with fellow artist Jean Vincent and songwriter Sharon Shealy en route to London after performing at the Bristol Hippodrome earlier that evening. The other two passengers survived with minor injuries, but Cochran, who had been thrown from the vehicle, suffered serious brain injuries and died at St Martin's Hospital in Bath. Though Cochran's best-known songs were released during his lifetime, more of his songs were released posthumously. His songs have been recorded by a wide variety of recording artists. Paul McCartney chose Cochran's 20 Flight Rock as his audition piece in attempt to impress John Lennon. It obviously worked, as McCartney was hired to join the Quarrymen, who would later become the Beatles. On the 18th of April 1989, thousands of students took to the streets of Beijing to issue a call for greater democracy in the People's Republic of China. Many Chinese citizens used the communist government's policy in the mid-1980s to move towards a liberalisation of the strictly controlled economy and attract more foreign investment as an opportunity to push for reforms of the communist-dominated political system. The peaceful protests mainly took the form of marches through China's largest cities. The biggest protest taking place in Tiananmen Square on the 18th of April, where thousands of students gathered, carrying banners and chanting slogans to call for a more democratic political atmosphere. The government's response to the protests became progressively harsh. Several demonstration leaders were arrested and anti-government officials who showed sympathy for their cause were purged. By June 1989, with the protests growing larger and foreign journalists capturing the dramatic events on film, the Chinese army was called in to brutally crush the movement. An unknown number of protesters were killed in what became known as the Tiananmen Square massacre. On the 19th of April 1824, George Gordon Byron, 6th Baron Byron, or simply Lord Byron, as he is more popularly known, died in Greece, where he had travelled to support the Greek struggle for independence from Turkey. Even today, he is considered a Greek national hero. Byron's scandalous history, exotic travels, and flamboyant life made such an impression on the world that the term Byronic was coined to mean romantic, arrogant, dark, and cynical. His marriage to Anne Isabella Milbank confounded and ostracised from high society after allegations of suspected incest with his half-sister, Byron fled England in 1816. Years of debauchery in Geneva and Venice were to follow before Byron, always an avid supporter of liberal causes, moved to Greece to train troops and join the Greek War for Independence. On the 20th of April 1689, deposed King James II began his siege of Derry in the north of Ireland. In 1688, Catholic James had been replaced on the throne by his Protestant daughter Mary and her husband William of Orange in a bloodless coup that became known as the Glorious Revolution. James fled to France but landed in Ireland in 1689, hoping to incite his Catholic supporters there and regain control of the British throne. Aided by French forces, he quickly captured Dublin before heading to Derry, where Irish supporters of Britain had fled. James's forces encircled the fortified city, subjecting it to a fierce bombardment, which caused devastating fires and significant loss of life. Despite this and other assaults, the city refused to surrender, and on 1st of August, after 105 days of siege, British forces finally arrived to relieve the defiant city, forcing James to retreat.
I'm going to read an article from Hearts Life called The Roots of Revolution. It's 75 years on from its publication. We look at how George Orwell's time in Hertfordshire inspired perhaps his most famous book, Animal Farm. The writer is Anne Crombergs. The little village of Wallington in North Hertfordshire appears on a first visit to have remained relatively untouched by time in the 85 years since George Orwell lived here. It was here he found inspiration for many of the settings and characters in his iconic novel Animal Farm, first published in 1945. A little sign saying Manor Farm can be seen on the roadside wall of the Great Barn, a large black timber-framed structure almost visible from the cottage on Kitts Lane, where Orwell, real name Eric Blair, lived between 1936 and 1940 with his wife Eileen. The writer probably had the lofty interior of the barn in mind for the scene in the novel, where Old Major, the prize middle white boar, shares his vision of animalism with the assembled creatures, encouraging them to believe in a new order in which humans are overthrown and animals enjoy the fruits of their own labour. Orwell's letters and diaries of the period show his close engagement with the politics of the era and his criticism of the rise of Stalinism, but also, and less well known, his hands-on experience as a smallholder, which enabled him to represent farming and farm animals with such authenticity. Orwell had the image of a pig in mind when he first made mention of Wallington. The village and animal farm is Willingdon, in a letter to a friend in February 1936. "I'm arranging to take a cottage at Wallington, near Baldock, in Herts. Rather a pig in a poke, because I've never seen it. It's very cheap, only 7 shillings and 6 pence a week." Situated at the heart of the village, the Stores was a primitive two-up, two-down with a corrugated metal roof and outside WC. It is opposite a piece of ground known as Kit's Peace, suitable grazing land for goats. By the time he moved there in April 1936, Orwell was planning to marry Eileen O'Shaughnessy, a postgraduate student he had met a year earlier at a party in London. On June the 9th, their wedding took place in the parish church of St. Mary's. Eva Wilson, a local villager, reported that the occasion was very simple. "Eileen and he walked down the road from the cottage together. George vaulted over the churchyard wall so as to be standing inside the gate to pick up Eileen and carry her to the church door, having plainly got his folklore muddled." In the months and years that followed, the couple established a working partnership deeply rooted in a country way of life, although one which ran in parallel to Orwell's ambitious programme of writing and journalism. He penned Shooting an Elephant and The Road to Wigan Pier here, even involving them both in active military service during 1937 in the Spanish Civil War. He returned to Wallington to draft Homage to Catalonia. When at home, they shared in the running of a village shop from their front room, selling local produce and sweets in order to pay the rent. They kept chickens and grew crops in the back garden, in time acquiring two goats named Muriel and Kate, which grazed on Kit's Peace. At intervals, Orwell, and occasionally Eileen, maintained a smallholder's diary. Muriel seems well, rather thin, appetite good. Still giving over 1.5 pints, close on a year in milk now. Yesterday planted a dozen carnations. Many apples forming. Strawberries should be netted about a fortnight from now. That's dated 26th of May, 1939. The diary shows Orwell's engagement in rearing livestock and cultivating crops all year round. From this way of life sprang the idea for Animal Farm, although by the time he actually began work on the novel, in November 1943, he and Eileen had taken a flat in central London, subletting the Wallington cottage to friends. At first, Orwell set out to write an explicit criticism of Stalin and totalitarianism. But according to Sylvia Topp, whose 2020 biography of Orwell reveals Eileen's crucial role in the crafting of Animal Farm, it was she who suggested writing the story as an allegory when the issue of Stalin as an ally made it difficult for his publisher in the original format. Orwell explained in a letter that his novel was about a farm run by people where the animals take over and make just as bad a job of it. Subtitled A Fairy Story, the work fuses political satire with the anthropomorphic characterization seen in Aesop's fables and the tales of Beatrix Potter, especially the tale of Pigling Bland. In a later preface to the novel, he recalled the precise moment years earlier in Wallington that had inspired him to write the story. He said, "I saw a little boy driving a huge cart horse along a narrow path, whipping it whenever it tried to turn. It struck me that if only such animals became aware of their own strength, we should have no power over them." For the fictional world of Manor Farm, Orwell certainly drew on his knowledge of Wallington and the surrounding area. The neighbouring Foxwood Farm derived from Quickswood, a local farm surrounded by woodland. The knoll where the animals gather is suggestive of the Whip, the field behind the old school. Muriel the Goat is a sympathetic portrayal of her real-life counterpart, whilst in Boxer, the stalwart old cart horse and the tragic hero of the novel, Orwell may have memorialised his Wallington neighbour, Fred Hatchett, Old H, who used to carry out heavy work for him in the garden. Fred was known for the way he walked on his heels, with the hobnails on his boots making a ringing sound like shire horses' hooves. Eileen is known to have had editorial input in the manuscript, and a particularly poignant example of this is perhaps Boxer's death scene. A thin stream of blood had trickled out of his mouth. "It's my lung," said Boxer in a weak voice. Orwell himself suffered from tubercular lesions on his lungs, which, while in Wallington in August 1938, had led him to hemorrhage very seriously. Animal Farm was considered too hot to handle by several major publishers, and after a series of rejection letters, Orwell considered publishing himself. However, Fred Warburg of Secker and Warburg eventually agreed to take it on. When, after its publication on August 17, 1945, several friends of Eileen read the novel, they sensed her light touch and humorous intelligence. Sadly, she herself died undergoing an operation in March 1945, while Orwell was abroad working as a war correspondent for The Observer. Orwell told a friend, "It was a terrible shame that Eileen didn't live to see the publication of Animal Farm, which she was particularly fond of and even helped in the planning of." The first print run of 4,500 copies sold out quickly, and a further run of 10,000 copies appeared in November. Subsequently translated into more than 70 languages, it has never been out of print. From the little fields of Wallington to the world, it is arguably the most effective critique of totalitarianism ever published.
Hello, my name's Sue, and this story is from Hertfordshire Life. It's called Heart's Heroines, and the words are by Caroline Thayne. To celebrate Women's History Month, we dive into the past to celebrate 10 Heart's Wonder Women, who were pioneers and game changers. From intrepid adventuring to fighting for equality and helping to change society, they deserve their place in the Heart's Hall of Fame. Dolly Shepherd. Before TV, and long before the internet, entertainment was experienced live. Crowds would flock to the village fair and watch performers such as Edwardian parachutist Dolly Shepherd jump into thin air. Born in 1886 in Potter's Bar, she made a name for herself performing the first mid-air parachute jumps, and extraordinarily saved another parachutist's life after their chute malfunctioned, but broke her back in the heroic act. Paralysed from the accident, Dolly made it into the Guinness Book of Records after she not only learned to walk again, against all the odds, but made it back up into the air soon after. Penny Hodges. A British engineer who worked on guided missile technology, Penny Hodges was awarded an OBE in 1972 for her contribution to the industry. Involved in the main professional bodies as one of the leading ladies of early science, technology, engineering and maths, STEM, she was also a member of Soroptimist International St Albans and District, part of a women's voluntary organisation to improve the lives of women and girls around the world, where she spent time and energy encouraging girls to take up engineering. Penny also won an award for her outstanding achievement in aviation, which was given to her by Prince Charles, and she featured in a TV documentary entitled Women in a Man's World. While one would hope that programme title is now outdated, women are still massively underrepresented in the STEM industries, with the female workforce making up just 13%. There's some way to go to continue Penny's work. Emily Davis. Emily Davis, 1830 to 1921, was a feminist, suffragette, and pioneering campaigner for women's access to university. She's mostly remembered for co-founding Girton College, the first university college in England for women. The college was originally located in Hitchin, but moved in 1873 to Cambridge. She strongly advocated an equal curriculum and quality of education for women as for men. Her tenacity was recognised with an honorary doctorate of law from the University of Glasgow in 1901. As a suffragist, Emily headed a delegation to Parliament and is known for opposing the militant methods of the suffragette movement. Margaret and Annie Johnson. Sisters Margaret and Annie Johnson were not just doing it for themselves, but arguably for women everywhere. As the first female police officers in Hertfordshire, the pair signed up in 1928. Based at a station in Ware, they moved around Hertfordshire wherever they were especially needed. In a male-dominated work environment, a lot of their work related to safeguarding women and children. Yet despite their much-needed skills, they didn't receive equal pay with their male counterparts for a staggering 45 years. They inspired more women to sign up to the constabulary, which in turn led to the numbers seen today. Now, approximately a third of Hearts Police are women, and there is almost no gender gap between the pay across staff. Still work to do, Margaret and Annie would no doubt say. Dame Ellen Terry. One of the most famous leading ladies of the Victorian era, Dame Ellen Terry was particularly celebrated for her Shakespearean heroines, such as Portia and Beatrice. A young talent and beauty, she left the stage for a while after she married the Pre-Raphaelite artist George Frederick Watts, aged just 16. An 1864 painting of her by Watts is in the National Portrait Gallery. He was 31 years older, and the marriage lasted only 10 months before she returned to her parents and went back to theatre work. Born to actor parents, six of Ellen's 11 siblings were also employed on the stage. Ellen appeared in her debut role as a child as Mamilius in The Winter's Tale at the Princess Theatre, London, in 1856, with Queen Victoria in the audience. Tripping over a wagon on stage didn't prevent her from going on to enjoy a highly acclaimed acting career. A notable part of her legacy was how she took on the male-dominated acting world by taking over the management of London's Imperial Theatre. Sadly, it was a financial flop. Undeterred, she turned to touring and lecturing to pass on her skills and knowledge. She spent many happy years living under pseudonyms in a cottage in Gustard Wood with the architect Edward Goodwin. Clementine Churchill. Behind every successful man is a strong woman, apparently. And certainly for Winston Churchill's wife, Clementine, 1885 to 1977, this adage is true. Churchill admitted World War II would have been impossible without her. Baroness Clementine Ogilvy Spencer Churchill, GB, to give her her full title, was a life peer in her own right, as well as being married to the Prime Minister. As a child, she lived in Berkhamsted, where there's a blue plaque commemorating her townhouse home in the High Street. As Clementine Hosier, she attended Berkhamsted School for Girls between 1900 and 1903. In the war, her ability to charm allies and her humanitarian efforts on the home front earned her not only the deep respect of her husband, but across Whitehall and the UK population too. Violet Cressy Marks. An explorer, mainly active between the world wars, Violet Cressy Marks travelled the globe many times over. Despite being married twice, she usually went alone. Modes of transport included sleigh, canoe, horse, cars, and on foot. Her brave accomplishments included being an ambulance driver with the Red Cross during World War II and securing a job as a war correspondent for the Daily Express. With primarily an archaeological purpose to her travel, Violet was also a capable filmmaker, photographer and author with an interest in zoology, and she reported on politically sensitive areas. A woman of her own means, she lived when she was in the country at Hazelwood House, now a hotel, in Abbots Langley. She's buried at Langleybury Church. Margaret Murray. Margaret Murray was a British Indian who studied Egyptology, archaeology, anthropology, and folklore. Supplementing her college lecturer wages by giving public classes and talks at the British Museum and the Manchester Museum, the latter led to her unwrapping Knupnacht, one of the mummies recovered from the Tomb of Two Brothers, among the largest and most beautifully decorated tombs in Saqqara, Egypt. This earned her the unique status as the first woman to publicly unwrap an ancient mummy. She taught at University College London between 1898 and 1935, working in the field with leading archaeologist William Finders Petrie in Egypt and the Middle East, and was a trained nurse and a social worker in her early career. She wrote several books on ancient Egypt and was an early feminist. Her influential and controversial work in the study of folklore and witchcraft theory led her to be dubbed the Grandmother of Wicca. She lived in Welwyn, where she died aged 100. Lucy Kemp Welsh. Lucy Kemp Welsh was an artist and tutor renowned for her paintings of horses, particularly those in military service in World War I, and for her illustrations for the 1915 edition of Black Beauty by Anna Sewell. Her dramatic Colt Hunting in the New Forest is in the National Collection at the Tate. During her career, she had 61 paintings displayed at the Royal Academy. She moved to Bushy to study at Hacoma Art School before running it until 1926 as the Bushy School of Painting and then the Kemp Welsh School of Animal Painting. Lucy lived in Bushy most of her life, in later years painting gypsy and circus horses. A large collection of her work can be seen at Bushy Museum and Art Gallery. Lucy died in Watford, age 89. And the last of our ladies is Audrey Collins. Audrey was not only a pioneering women's cricketer, she also taught chemistry at St Albans Girls Grammar School for 35 years. Born in India in 1915, she moved to England after her father died in the Great War, when she was just 12. Her story proves that a turbulent childhood need not hold back success and fulfilment. A chemistry graduate at the University of London, her talent at cricket saw her play for several teams and become an English Test cricketer, playing in the 1937 Ashes. She was later elected chairwoman of the Women's Cricket Association, further driving the women's game forward. She was awarded an OBE for her services to cricket, and when she died, aged 94 in 2010, the England team on tour in India wore black armbands and observed a minute's silence in her honour. A founder of Radlett Women's Cricket Team, girls' teams in Hertfordshire are awarded the Audrey Collins Cup, a lasting legacy to this remarkable woman.
We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Jenny, Vivian, Claire and Margaret, for the news, Penny for reading the events in history, Sue for her reading from Heart's Life, and of course Jilly for the radio listings, Helen for the audio described TV listings, and Rupert for his nature notes. TN Soundings provided the quiz and the 10 today exercises. Marley will be here next week with Red Saturn, but that's all from me in April 2024. We close with Jacqueline Hines' wonderful recording of The Ashplant and Red-Haired Lass. I do hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now, and keep well.